Travel Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host in Hiroshima. Today we're talking about design and architecture. And we have a wonderful guest joining us from Melbourne, Australia. Okay, can you please say your name correctly before we start?
Athanasios Sakonas.
It's a beautiful name. I'm so sorry, I couldn't get it right. But you have, we kind of have been connecting over the years since I've been doing this show. You always have wonderful comments and, of course, really enjoy Asby Brown and the wonderful design and architecture related talks we have. We're going to talk first about your teaching and connection to Kenzo Tange and the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. But let's start with Green Legacy Hiroshima and this wonderful eucalyptus tree and the connection back to where you are.
Ah, yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me on this morning. This is actually a really interesting story that developed from the research that my partner and I were working on over the past few years, which has culminated in an exhibition that's now on in Yokohama. And what it was is that we came across this eucalyptus tree in Hiroshima, an atomic bomb tree, and we knew about it from quite a few years ago. But because of the exhibition, which looked at the eucalyptus designs at the Yokohama War Cemetery, it started to take a little bit more presence in the story. And so we explored it a little bit further, and through some research that a colleague was able to do for us in Japanese archives, we discovered this tree, in fact, originally came from Victoria, where I'm from.
Amazing.
And it has a really interesting journey to Japan, because it was at a time in the 1870s where Australia was, you know, involved with some of these world exhibitions, world fairs. It would take over produce and materials, and believe it or not, timber to show to the world. And at that time, I think it was the 1876 exhibition in Vienna, that Victoria had a table and a whole range of eucalyptus seeds had been brought over. And we believe that it was at that exhibition that a Japanese delegation who visited decided to take some seeds back to Japan. And it has ended up at the Hiroshima Castle. And I think one of the things that they were promoting at the time was this wonderful tree that was very unique, very indigenous to Australia. It was being cultivated for its hard timber properties, but also its leaves were able to be, they had actually detected that the leaves could produce eucalyptus oil. So the tree itself had an anti-malarial property, and I think Japan and other parts of the world were starting to consider, well, how do you tackle mosquitoes and malaria, and therefore why don't we plant a grove of eucalyptus trees? So they took one back to Japan. It ends up at Hiroshima Castle, and then it survives the atomic bombing in 1945.
Well, it's one of the certified A-bomb survivor trees, they're called now. So these are trees within the 2-kilometer blast zone, which grew back within a year and gave local people so much hope, because everybody was told nothing's going to grow for hundreds of years. Nobody really knew. And so when I do tours of Hiroshima and I take people by this tree all the time, it has a wonderful fragrance, but it's always surprising to see a tree that really does not look indigenous to Japan at all. So what an interesting backstory that it was actually brought over from a world fair in the 1800s. Amazing.
One of the interesting things was the Peace Memorial Museum at Hiroshima sent me a photograph of the tree taken within days of the blast. There was a Japanese photographer who had visited, And you could see how devastated it was. And then it was able to really take off and shoot up. And it actually grew quite substantially. But apparently a typhoon hit in the 1970s and snapped it. So that caused a lot more damage, but it has managed to survive since then. And and it's actually thriving based on what we saw.
It is. And I heard that there used to be three eucalyptus in a row right on that same bank. And that typhoon wiped out the other two and they did not grow back. So the tree that survived is really a survivor, not just of the atomic blast, but of the typhoons as well. And when you look at this tree, it's very special. And it's one of the most special certified by this group called Green Legacy Hiroshima. You can see the group founders here and important staff who protect these trees. They write plaques on the trees that say what kind of tree it is and how far from the epicenter it is. And they also take saplings and seeds and send them around the world to places trying to rebuild after war or educational facilities. And you said you are getting seeds back to Melbourne. Is that right?
Yes, we've had we've been in contact with Green Legacy Hiroshima now for about 2 years. And they have a relationship now with the University of Melbourne to where we bring in seeds or ginkgo seeds for that matter to transplant or to, as for commemorative projects. But our interest was in bringing back some of the eucalyptus seeds and see if we can germinate them here in Victoria as a gesture of reconciliation, which is part of the bigger project that we were working on through the Eucalypsa Horogaia exhibition. And we have been allocated a place at the Springvale War Cemetery, which is in Melbourne. We had one batch come through first. Unfortunately, the pods in which the seeds reside were taken from the tree too soon, so there was nothing in there. And we've got some wonderful partners here in Melbourne because we're working alongside with the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, who were going to undertake the germination process for us. So now with Nazrin and the Green Legacy team, we're trying another approach to see whether or not we can try and graft a small sample, maybe in Hiroshima first, so we can test it before we bring it here. But we will try again once we get another batch of ripened trees. It's very difficult to explain 10,000 miles away when exactly to look out for when the trees are ready to open up the seed pods and catch these little micro seeds. So that in itself has been a challenge, but we're hopeful. We're very hopeful it'll happen.
Well, I hope it works out. This is such a special tree. I've seen survivors doing media interviews in front of this tree because scientists have said the way that it grew back after the bombing shows the DNA has been scrambled by the radiation. And so in the tree, you do see round leaves and long leaves in the same tree, which apparently is not supposed to happen. Those are two different kinds of eucalyptus. And so I've heard survivors standing in front of this tree saying, like me, my DNA has also been scrambled. And so my grandchildren are still worried about, is it okay to have kids or not? And this is the lasting legacy of nuclear weapons and why nuclear weapons should never be used again, right? And exactly. So it's such an important tree for continuing to tell these stories, right? Yes. So what a wonderful tree for you to have a connection to in Melbourne as well.
But I think there's also another connection to Hiroshima that that sort of came through this research. At that time after the war, immediately after the war, it was actually the zone of operation for the Australian contingent as part of the British Commonwealth Occupation Force. And there was early attempts to begin the planning of the devastation zone in Hiroshima, one of the people who was invited to be an advisor on the Reconstruction Authority was a Major Stanley Jarvey, an Australian architect who comes from New South Wales. And in one of his early plans, which was ultimately not accepted by the authority because they wanted a more indigenous or a more local approach to the scheme, he actually proposed a radial scheme for the, which is now the Memorial Park in Hiroshima. And that included planting thousands of eucalyptus trees across Hiroshima, firstly, in part to tackle the malaria outbreak that was going to, was occurring at that time because of the water bodies that were running nearby. And he got so far as he started to have a BCOF farm in Shimogahara start planting saplings of little eucalyptus trees because they envisaged this is what was going to happen. Eventually, it didn't get realized because they opened up the master planning to that competition, which Kenzo Tange won in 1946 or 49. And those trees actually ended up in Yokohama being planted at the war cemetery there.
Which we're going to talk about in a little while, because that's a wonderful, another connection to eucalyptus, also peace and memorials, which is the focus of your work and education and big project in Yokohama. Sounded really interesting. Of course, that's a beautiful part of the Peace Park design, is how it was a city, part of the city center, but completely devastated by the bombing. And so Kenzo Tange's design to make so much open space have so many trees, but yes, I do not see any other eucalyptus trees in Hiroshima. But talk a little bit about Kenzo Tange's design, because I know you know a lot about that as well.
Well, this is one of the projects that I show my students as one of the ideal projects for commemoration. And how do you intervene in such a sensitive site? And that is because, firstly, obviously, it was a devastated site. So it's in effect a tabula rasa, just a flat open area. But there was the remains of an exhibition building there, which became the A-bomb site, as you call it, designed by a Czech architect, a modernist architect at the time. So Kenzo Tange had to make a decision about how he would approach this. And from his perspective, he decided that the A-bomb site was central to the scheme. And he decided that there would have to be a central axis, a north-south axis. Central to the site was not only the A-bomb building, but at the other end of the axis, he needed a center that could tell the story, which was the Peace Museum. So he decided to anchor the two ends of the park with these two significant structures, and then in the center place a cenotaph. And one of the things we ask students about how do you design in these places is what kind of an intervention is warranted, and how does it reflect on the original, the existing sacred space, but what can it offer visitors and the public in the future? What does it inform you? And I think Kenzo Tange, in his design, which is very brutalist, you know, in that sense, it's very monumental, it's very significant. It's a large imposing box on elevated pilotis or columns. He addresses that by saying there is a future, and the future in reconstruction is modernism. And, you know, he's inspired by some of the European masters, Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, and he conceives this box with a very Japanese aesthetic, you know, the idea of the store shed elevated off the ground was his inspiration. And he makes a statement. He makes an imposing statement, but he still provides a view corridor right through the park to open up the park. So the site itself is exposed to the surrounding city and is connected to the city in that way. Now, funnily enough, Kenzo Tange, just on a side to that, Kenzo Tange actually attempted a similar way of opening a site up, an important site up, by lifting a building in Singapore, where he did a high-rise bank building on the banks of the Singapore River near where the Parliament House is. And it was unusual at the time, and it was exemplary in that he lifted up an entire tower, skyscraper, off the ground on columns so that everybody can walk through and make a connection. And there's a similarity from his endeavors at Hiroshima.
That's so interesting. It's, of course, the main place that people visit when they come to Hiroshima. It is the new center of the city as the city of peace, right? It's a very important place to visit. He also designed underneath the peace flame, which I've heard is supposed to look like arms embracing the peace flame and the reflection pool and the cenotaph. I've also heard that Isamu Noguchi was invited to kind of help design the cenotaph. Have you heard that?
I'm not aware of.
Just the bridges, yeah. Just
the bridges, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that flame is a wonderful story, how it comes from the island of Miyajima, where Kukai, the monk Kukai, started the flame 1,200 years ago. And the monks say they've kept it alive, and that was borrowed to start the peace flame. But that temple where Kukai started and the flame had been kept alive has just burnt down completely. Oh, really? So it's kind of nice that now the Peace Park flame is going to be borrowed when they rebuild that temple and taken back to Miyajima Island is a wonderful way to continue that legacy, right?
That's amazing. Yeah. We first visited it in 2006, and I was trying to find an image for you because, which has got cultural resonance to me, my background, is that Melina Mercouri, who was the arts minister in Greece at the time, had visited and had left a note there specifically, and I couldn't find it for you.
I'll try to look for that next time I'm there. But just beautiful lines, modernism, you say, brutalism, very strong designs under the flame here, looking out at the reflection pool toward the museum.
One of the interesting things that Tange did was he created a visual corridor through the main axis, but he didn't allow pedestrian access through it. It got interrupted by the water. And this is a pattern that I've seen in a number of places around the world where you deliberately allow people to wander around it. And it creates a sense of the sacred in that center. And positioning the cenotaph in that way allows people to always view the cenotaph with a backdrop and an aspect, right? And one of the things that I'm really curious about is how do people respond when they visit these sacred spaces? How do you create a sense of emotion, a sense of anticipation, a sense of reverence when you visit these sites? And sometimes or often it's better to achieve that by allowing them a discrete distance in which they can then approach it from a particular way. And I think architects are very good at that, in being able to guide the people through the way they position pathways and access points. And that's one of the things that's quite lovely. And in fact, you kind of not realize that as you're walking around it, there is a central body of water, but there are two bodies of water either side. And they're almost oblivious to you because you're focused on the direction of where you're going.
That is, that's a beautiful part of the design. I'd never thought about it that way. But of course, keeping people away and observing from outside as a sign of respect of a sacred place, but also for photos. And you always have that beautiful photo looking through the cenotaph or from the museum up the peace line, as they call it, right?
It means everything is connected. It means everything respects the other, and it's a way of creating that narrative of peace and reconciliation, you know, through the modern and the destroyed.
Wow. Well, let's shift to talk about the Yokohama War Memorial Cemetery. That's a really significant project, and you've just been in Tokyo setting it up, and it runs until October. Tell us a little bit about this amazing project.
This project, and we called it Eucalypts of Horogaya. It started a couple of years ago as a research project where we unearthed this information that the Yokohama War Cemetery had actually been designed by a group of Australian architects and horticulturalists from a war graves team called the ANZAC Agency. And they were an agency of the then Imperial War Graves Commission looking after the Australian, Southeast Asian, South Pacific theatre of the war. It turns out many of these architects came from the University of Melbourne's architectural school at the time where we taught. They also happen to live nearby where we are currently living, from the sort of same neighbourhood. And they were offered an opportunity to design the war cemetery for Japan. And I guess, I mean, if I go back a bit, the end of the war happened, and the first most pressing need was to account for and bury the dead. And in that task, Japan had been allocated to Australia to deal with, whereas the British were looking after Southeast Asia and more into South Asia. So Australian and American war graves teams scoured the country from the north to the south, identifying who was missing, who was buried, and they set up a whole series of these temporary burial grounds across the country, including one at Etajima, where the Australians would have their headquarters. And in fact, that was one of the possible places for a national war cemetery, Etajima. And then they had to make a decision as to where you would create a permanent war cemetery for the Commonwealth dead, because the Americans had decided early on that their remains must all go back home and be interred either in, well, they were given an option. You could either be interred in Manila or Hawaii or back on mainland United States. But the Imperial War Graves Commission, or the Commonwealth War Graves Commission as it's known today, they had a mandate from the First World War, a set of policies which said no, the Commonwealth dead must remain and be buried in the place where they fell. So these Australian designers started to explore Japan, and a decision was made to, well, they identified this amusement park, a children's amusement park on the outskirts of Yokohama in the Horogaya Ward. And the Horogaya Ward, for those who don't know or might not know, is the fourth station on the Edo to Kyoto Road, right? One of those stations that Hiroshige had drawn. And this amusement park had been set up in the 1920s through funding from the public and the local authorities. The authorities decided that was the most beautiful setting because it was an expansive landscape with undulating terrain, and it had these flat spaces. And therefore, that was the decision. So the Australian architects got to work designing it, and they worked with Japanese architects and horticulturalists and contractors in which to build this. And we argue in our exhibition and our paper that this became Australia and Japan's first act of genuine reconciliation immediately after the war, before there was a peace treaty or any such thing. And of course, all of these architects, all of the Australian architects had just been returned service people themselves and had experienced the conflict and were asked to put aside their differences and come to tackle this design. One of the architects himself had been a prisoner of war in Japan at the Zensuji POW camp. So one of the Japanese architects himself had been in the Imperial Japanese Army and had survived. So they put aside their differences and they started to collaborate on this project, and it's turned into a much more bigger story through the kind of materials and information that we got through the families from Japan, from Australia, from the United States to create this exhibition. The exhibition opened in Melbourne on August the 15th, you know, to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the end of the war last year, and it runs until this coming August. The Yokohama version of the exhibition, which is a traveling version, we were invited to bring it to Yokohama by the Archives of History Museum. And that opened on Anzac Day, which is April the 25th this year, and it'll run until October the 25th. And we hope people get an opportunity to come and see it because it's a very important site in Japan, one that most people just don't know about. And one of the aims of our project is to elevate its presence because Japan already has two critical sacred sites to deal with the war, one being obviously the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park and the other being the Yasukuni Shrine Complex, commemorating two different aspects of the war. Yokohama War Cemetery looks at the third aspect, which is all those Allied service people who died in the conflict, right? And now are buried so far away from their homelands in Japan itself.
And I've read 1,555 are buried there from the Commonwealth, as well as Canada, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, UK, and yes. India, right?
Yes. So the cemetery is actually designed in five spatial grounds, which is very unusual because a conventional Commonwealth War Cemetery is a combination, is basically a flat terrain where possible, everybody arranged in a lawn cemetery, so to speak. The Australians, on the other hand, when they took over this site, considered it very differently. They decided that they would arrange it in nationalities. So they had a large British section, which occupied the former athletic field and running track. Nearby that, there would be an Australian section for about 240 Australian dead. After that, along these winding pathways, you would come to a combined New Zealand-Canadian section. There was also a small little Indian Forces section for those who died from the subcontinent, and that could include India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal. And then there is a fifth section which sits on the ground of where a former Japanese monument was, what we call a chukanhai, or a lost souls monument, which had been dedicated to the Russo-Japanese War. And in that site, they decided they would set up the fifth a burial ground for post-war dead, people who died during the Commonwealth occupation period of Japan. But also there are people who died in the Korean War who were brought back, and includes also a notable civilian, Len Harrop, who was the actual caretaker for the cemetery for 50 years, is buried there.
And there's one section which does also include U.S. soldiers in a cremated remains area in
yes.
an urn. Is that right?
So this is So this is the Yokohama Cremation Memorial. It's a small little structure, about 6 meters by 7 meters, and in it there is an urn of ashes which sits on a pedestal, and it contains the remains of about 335 Allied servicemen whose remains got mixed up and could not be separated. And they decided that rather than try to find a way of separating them, we would combine them, leave them as it is, and preserve them in memory in this small little structure. And that structure itself is really quite significant. And I use that as a teaching tool, because one of the underlying things about the design of the cemetery is the way in which the Japanese influence, the cultural and the social influence, came into the designing through the Japanese architects. And it's only, and we only just started to realize what they meant. And that, so I'll just jump back a second because I got ahead of myself. In a conventional Commonwealth War Cemetery, you predominantly use a single stone for your structures and your headstones and other reliefs. Maybe you use some bricks, depending on where you are located. But in essence, you keep the materials to the minimum. Yokohama is an amazing exception to that. There's something like 10 or 11 different types of stone that are used in the cemetery. Some of the pieces are so obscure and so carefully selected that you started to wonder where it came from. And this came to us because we were looking at through the archives, we were looking at the original drawings, and we couldn't quite make out why are there so many different names for materials. And it turns out that the Japanese architects had very carefully considered this space and decided that they would impose a funereal tradition onto an otherwise Allied war cemetery. I'll give you a really good example. In that cremation memorial, there is an upturned pedestal with a top, and the urn sits on top of that. Yeah, that's it. Now, that piece of stone on top of that pedestal, we discovered that it was something called Koka Sarasa stone. It comes from a particular region in Japan. It's a speckled stone. And what we realized was that the Koka means, it comes from the word, from the magazine Koka, which is the art or the essence of a nation. It was a famous or a very important journal in the 19th century in Japan. The word Sarasa comes from the Portuguese, which is chintz fabric. So there are these two meanings to this one piece of stone that comes from an obscure valley in the north of Japan. The idea of the traditional values, but at the same time, fabric. And what it told us was that they actually were using the stone almost metaphorically as the cloth that has to sit below the urn vase, which prevents the spirits of the urn transcending below, right? So they use the white cloth and they use a piece of stone to do that, right? So at that level, they were thinking about the funereal tradition in a sacred space like that. And it wasn't just that. For example, one of the things that we found fascinating was that they used as the main building block for the cemetery, the Oya stone, which had come to prominence in Japan through Frank Lloyd Wright's use of it at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. So we were wondering, well, how does that come about? Well, you have to sort of think back into an architectural training at the time. And we're trying to remember that the Australian architects and the Japanese architects at the time who were working on this, they were just young men. They all had their training in the 1920s, 30s, and they were all being exposed to the emerging modernism that was coming out of Europe. Importantly, they were also being exposed to some of the work that was coming out of the United States through Frank Lloyd Wright and the Prairie School. And at the time, Frank Lloyd Wright's work in Japan was globally known. It was revolutionary. And the way he selected this obscure stone that had been fallen out of favor, the Oya stone. So then you find that the Australian architects also knew about this material. And the two Japanese architects, Yoji Kasajima and Michael Iwanaga, were also similarly aware of it and were influenced by it. In particular, Kasajima, who happened to, after graduating, be living and working in a girls' school in Tokyo, the Jiyu Gakuen, which was actually the original building for that school was Frank Lloyd Wright's first project in Japan before the Imperial Hotel, and he had used Oya stone for that building. So Kasajima introduces this stone to the cemetery and takes one of the Australian architects all the way up to Tochigi Prefecture to look at the mines where it's sourced. And we're talking 1940s, right? So travel is difficult. Everything is complicated. You don't have easy access to the country in that sense. So they introduced this wonderful stone throughout the cemetery. And that's just one of many.
That's amazing. And the integration, this is something that it just sparked an idea because talking to Hiroko Yoda and her book, 8 Million Ways to Happiness, and how she talks about in Japan, how they are very comfortable with mixing religious or spiritual elements from different countries and making their own and things of good luck, bad luck. And so what you're talking about integrating architectural design ideas as making the war cemetery for the war dead, and that integration of spiritual concepts, meaningful stone, all using these different ideas together in kind of course, there's crosses and religious symbols, which may have been problematic for some people, how they didn't identify as Christian, right? For example, but in Japan, there's less conflict about mixing these different ideas together, perhaps. Was that not an issue for some people who were maybe Muslim or atheist for the families, for them to have their war dead buried together in a common theme, spiritual theme?
Well, that's the perennial question with the Commonwealth War Graves Project, because ostensibly it's a Christian idea, and it symbolized and it's symbolized quite prominently through the cross of sacrifice that they put in the war cemeteries. And you just reminded me, I can't believe I forgot, the cross of sacrifice that you see at Yokohama, which you can see in the images there, that one being the Australian one, previous one being in the British, it actually was constructed out of Inada stone, Inada granite. They specifically chose that particular material. And one of the things that's really interesting is that that stone itself was used in the National Diet building, the Supreme Court, and more importantly, it was the same stone used on Hiroshima's atomic bomb dome, right? And again, we asked the question, why would you select this particular material given the number of materials that you have? What is the symbolism to that? What is the meaning to that? The only gesture that they made to religion or to some form of considering religion in or the differences in culture at Yokohama, the war cemetery, was in the Indian Forces section, where they created a cenotaph rather than a dedicated cross of sacrifice, obviously, because the majority of the dead in that plot are in fact Muslim men from the south, from the subcontinent.
That's really interesting. Talk also about, like, in the Peace Park as well, this is something we always see, the beautiful rose garden along the peace line, right? And then in this Yokohama War Cemetery for the war dead from the Commonwealth, you have beautiful plants and trees. Can you talk a little bit about that design?
Yes. The horticulture for Yokohama, the original horticultural design was by a gentleman called Alec Macy. And when he visited Japan, one of the most interesting things that he did was he decided that the existing landscape, which was in effect hillside, hinoki pine type of, the ubiquitous landscape of the mountainscapes of Japan, he decided that he's going to start infusing a Japanese flavor to it, not only introduce species of trees that reflected the nationalities of those who were buried there. And obviously he introduced a lot of eucalyptus trees throughout the premises. But they started to introduce sakura and other plants and create what we call a strolling garden through Yokohama. And you come across that as you walk through these paths or these winding pathways, which lead you onto other sections, other views. So it differs considerably from the conventional. And in fact, it differs considerably from a traditional Japanese garden, which is manicured to that extent, because it's a hybrid of both the natural and the made in terms of the landscape. The backdrops are quite stunning. And when we were there in April this year, the flowers had started to bloom. It was vividly, green, but it does change over the seasons. The ginkgo trees that line some of the pathways all drop their leaves at the same time, and you get these yellow carpets that fall over the headstones. It's probably one of the most beautiful landscape gardens that we've ever seen, and arguably probably the most beautiful war cemetery that the Commonwealth has produced in the world, for that matter.
That's so interesting. And, having a beautiful place that you can visit and commemorate those who lost their lives reminds me of a visit I had recently to Kobe in Hyogo Prefecture. And they're doing so many interesting sustainable design for the community. And one of them was recreating a new type of cemetery, which you will put the ashes in biodegradable containers along a beautiful forest path. Instead of having stone, typical where people have to go and, you know, take care of the graves, which is typical of Japanese culture, they're actually making a much more natural place because not having that obligation to go and take care of the graves, which is becoming more difficult as families move apart. And even like a war cemetery here, people living in other parts of the world who want to know that the graves are being taken care of. And what a beautiful way to commemorate that by adding nature, adding trees and beautiful flowers that continue to grow, not just cut flowers, right? So I love that connection there. It's a wonderful way to think about those who've left, right?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, but their biggest challenge at the moment is actually the maintenance, the landscape maintenance of these cemeteries. And, you know, across the world, they are looking after well over 1 to 1.5 million graves, over thousands of cemeteries across the world. And the perennial question is, how do you maintain this landscape in places where, for example, water is scarce? We have different extreme temperatures now, which are creating distress in a lot of places. And how do you get about managing this kind of terrain? I have to, you know, pay my respects to the team at the Yokohama War Cemetery, because it's a team of four that are maintaining a site of about 26 hectares. You know, it's amazing that they can manage that, and they have to do it seasonally, because, you know, winter, summer, spring and fall, there are different needs that have to be addressed. And one of the things that people forget is that the war cemeteries are in perpetuity. They're not there for a limited time. They will continue so long as they are needed. And you have to constantly keep updating some of the plant life. One of the things that we also discovered was the caretaker or the supervisor for the cemetery from about 1952 onwards was Len Harrop. And he is a prominent, he had a prominent role in the building up of the Japanese landscape and the sustainability of Yokohama, because he was able to be attentive to it over a 50-year span whilst there.
Yeah, amazing. I'm putting the link here for the Yokohama War Cemetery for the Commonwealth War Dead. And one of the things that they said in the website is how they have the challenge of typhoons, of course, in Japan too. So you're talking about upkeep, right? The cost of upkeep. Who is responsible for the cost? Is that something Japan's government takes on, or is that the Commonwealth? Do you know?
The maintenance of Commonwealth War Cemeteries is comes from a central fund that is collected from the nations of those who are buried there. And it's apportioned to the numbers of people who are buried there. So, for example, the United Kingdom, having the greatest number, will pay the largest proportion of this fund. Australia will pay based on a proportion of how many Australians across the world. And that's the ongoing process for that. I mean, there is talk, there's always talk about how do you manage so many sites that are actually quite small, where you might have three or four burials. How do you manage, and you know, this is in particular in places like Europe, in Asia, one of the things that they did, which was different to the European theatre, was they tended to consolidate the cemeteries in selected areas so that we have far less, but of greater number than what you find, for example, on the Western Front in northern France, for example, or across the Mediterranean. And I think that in a way has been quite helpful. And in the case of Japan, it's a single cemetery, you see, as opposed to if it had been, you know, in Europe, they would have probably said, okay, there had to be three or four because the concentrations of where people had died and originally been buried were spread out over a number of places in Japan during that period. Australia has the same problem because we have war cemeteries across all the major capital cities and other places in the interior. There's even a Japanese war cemetery in regional New South Wales at Cowra, and these all have to be maintained, and they're maintained perennially. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an piece. It's how to maintain peace through trees and through memorials. If people are able to go to the exhibit in Yokohama, which ends in October, what can people expect to see when they go to the exhibit in Yokohama or even in Melbourne about the?
Sorry about that. Hang on.
Are you able to hear? Okay.
I can. You might have to repeat that. We're just trying to.
Can you just give us an overview? If people are able to go to the exhibition in Yokohama, what are they able to see there?
Yes. So we brought along a series of panels and created almost like a diorama of the material that comprises the history of the design of the cemetery and the people involved. But at the same time, there is a number of publications that we wanted to highlight that were attributed to the understanding of the cemetery and the people involved. We also have a selection of stone samples that, and I needed to give this as a big shout out because the stone contractor, the original stone contractor for Yokohama was Yabashi Marble. And they are still in existence today. They are Japan's preeminent stone contractor, and their generosity in helping us source the materials across Japan for our exhibition was wonderful. And in fact, they gave us a tour of the president of Yabashi Marble gave us a walking tour of downtown Tokyo, and showed us literally most buildings can be attributed to them providing and installing the stone, including a tour of the National Diet Building because they completed the interior stonework for the National Diet Building, which was just wonderful. People can visit. It's on at the Yokohama Archives History Museum, which was the former British consulate building in Japan, the site where Commodore Perry signed the peace treaty, the Kanagawa Treaty. It's a wonderful site, and it'll be on until October.
That's fantastic. I hope people have a chance to go and see it. Now, just we have about 5 more minutes. I'd love to know more about the sustainable design that you're teaching your students with respect to Indigenous cultures in Australia. Just touch on that a little bit.
Okay, just an overview of that is that in Australia since 2023, there is a mandate to introduce Indigenous learning to architecture students. And this is a requirement that the Architects Accreditation Council of Australia has mandated, that you must be knowledgeable in our First Nations story and ways to be a registered architect, to be eligible to be registered as an architect in practice. And one of the things about this is that it allows us to teach students about how you see the country through an Indigenous perspective or a First Nations perspective. And one of the key elements of that is understanding what we call country with a capital C, which is the First Nations connection to the land, the skies, the waters of this nation. And it's not, and in a way, it's actually sustainability at its very fundamental, because it looks at the way a culture is so connected to the resilience and sustainability of its land and its resources, and how it maintains them. And we try and teach this to the students, and I do it through a field trip. And by students, these are postgraduate students. They're entering the master's course, so it's the first year, first semester. They go on a field trip to understand how their site was conceived. And in our case, because we do a project at Victoria's Shrine of Remembrance, which is our most sacred site, I take them to a quarry about 64 kilometres east of Melbourne, and I show them how this quarry, which is a big open pit, ends up to get them to understand that to build something, you must destroy something else. And what is the consequence of that? Because it's a resource that has been moved, excavated and moved from a land this far away, brought to another place in the city and reassembled with a particularly different cultural background. You know, they understand it. At the same time, they're exposed to the way the landscape has changed, and in particular in Australia, how, you know, traditional lands of the First Nations people have been stripped of their native vegetation and turned into farmland, right? Which is, you know, for cows, for example, to graze, again, an imported animal. So we teach them to be respectful of the resources that are out there. We teach them how to consider how the buildings that they do, what are the consequences of their action? How do you disassemble a building, for example, eventually? How do you find sustainable materials and sustainable practices? It's sort of on the margins about sustainable practice, because we've industrialized to such an extent that a lot of traditional practices are also starting to go away. In particular, you know, traditional carpentry. So they're exposed to this, and I think eventually when they come out, this generation that's coming forward is going to be much more considerate to our built environment and our natural resources. And I think that's a positive thing. That's a really positive thing.
That is very positive and something we'd need more of in all design and architecture, to respect the materials, to talk about reuse, regenerative, but also just, I think it's good for tourism as well, because like you said, touring around Tokyo and understanding where this stone comes from and what's the significance of the stone in the memorials. I'll be talking about that for the A-bomb dome, now that I know that it's a special kind of stone that Jan Letzel chose in 1915. So our history and our materials, the environment, the culture, it's all integrated. You're doing wonderful work. Thank you so much.
I think, you know, it's really about placemaking. It's about giving people in their cities an opportunity to be engaged with it, to connect with it. Good architecture is about having a dialogue with the public. It could be a private building, but at the same time, it's open to the public. Its face is open to the public. It has a story to tell. The more people are aware of that story, I like to tell the students, it's not just about architecture. You know, who was the builder? Who were the laborers? Or as my partner always says in one of her books, it's about the hidden hands that go into creating this story, because there are so many people involved and so many processes involved, you know, not just materials. And through that understanding, you hope that with a public that's more aware of their public domain, you hope that what comes up next and how it's preserved is better informed.
Absolutely. And that reminds me of the last talk we had with Asby Brown, right? Talking about living in a house that you can see the craftsmanship in the building makes you feel as a human more comfortable. And I think that idea of connection to craftspeople, connection to natural materials, that's all sustainable building for sure. And how we can regenerate and reuse as well in the end stage.
Yes, it's definitely important. One of the other things, or one of the great challenges that we're all grappling with at the moment, and I think this is it's a global thing, is that we're grappling with a lot of mental health issues. People who are living in particular in apartments, how do you design to improve mental health? So we talk about sustainability, and it's easy to go straight to the natural resources and to the environment. But because my background is actually in public housing, that's where I started from in Singapore. And I could see how you could create public housing to stimulate community interaction and engagement. And I'm consciously aware now, seeing the explosion of housing in Victoria and Australia, there is a lot of challenges out there for people, especially post-COVID. How do you live in a community, in an environment that allows you to have a mental sustainability? Maybe that's the phrase we need to think about, rather, you know, environmental sustainability, yes, but there's also got to be a mental sustainability, because this is a generation that has to look after the generation that's coming after it, et cetera, et cetera. And they have to be resilient and they have to be looked after. And we have to take care of the people ahead of us and the people behind us.
Absolutely. Wonderful place to end this time, but I would love to have you on again and talk more about mental health and housing design and public housing, because I think that is a very important issue for quality of life in our societies, in Japan, in Australia, around the world as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Joy.